Thanks for coming along tonight, folks. Ehud Iyari makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. As you know, he's been here quite a few times before, and we always look forward to him coming and talking to us. And thanks to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, who made Ehud's visit here tonight possible. He's well known, so I'll introduce him very briefly. He's the Middle East correspondent for the Channel 12 News in Israel, a very important news channel. And he's also a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Studies in Washington, D.C. And the topic for tonight's talk is looking ahead to the post-Gaza war era. Ehud Iyari, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard. I'm very happy to be again at the Sydney Institute. It's always a pleasure. I promise I will be frank and sometimes blunt, hoping that you will excuse me for that. I will start by where we are coming from. I think people now we have a war of simultaneously. It's only one that it's the war in Gaza. But there are other wars, and they are all linked together to the fight against or for the Iranian attempt to establish their predominance all over the region. I'm not going into all the wars that are raging on. I'll just give one or two examples. The Turks are about to invade northern Iraq to establish a 40 kilometers deep security zone. And they will also act again in Syria, militarily. In Syria, we have enormous amount of clashes in the north, east of the country, between different players. And we have a confrontation between Syria and Jordan with the Jordanian Air Force, small air force, capable pilots, for the first time ever hitting targets inside Syria. Because the Syrian army, the 4th Division, under the command of the brother of President Assad, Maher, with Iranian-sponsored militias, are moving, smuggling huge amounts of drugs, mainly amphetamines, Captagon, and weapons, rockets, anti-tank missiles, etc., across the border into Jordan, trying to build a military infrastructure there, at this point sleeping cells, and getting weapons across into the West Bank. And I can go on and on and on. Gaza is but one front, a very important one, of what's going on now. Now, what really happened in Gaza? The Israeli intelligence community had known since 2021, with indications before, about a plan called the Walls of Jericho of Hamas to invade Israel. They didn't really take it seriously. They felt they were deterred. Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, now deep in the bunker, was interested in improving the lives of the people in Gaza. They felt that by allowing Qatar to send to Gaza suitcases with millions of dollars cash, they can buy quiet or an extended ceasefire. On the night before the October 7th attack, they had more indications that something was imminent. But Hamas, for many months before, was holding a big drill called the Tall Pillar, in which they would train their fighters, their terrorists, on how to get to Israeli military positions across the border with Gaza, how to capture a kibbutz or a village, etc. So our people were accustomed to seeing this drill. And when they learned that the elite commando unit of Hamas called the Nukba, Nukba is elite in Arabic, the chosen ones, were called to the mosques at 3 a.m. in the morning, they felt, oh, we have another stage of the drill that we already know a lot about. But it was not. So there was a consultation at night between the generals, Israel too in Hebrew, heading our military intelligence, people who should not have been appointed to these sensitive positions in the first place. They had a consultation, and they decided we'll wait for the morning. What they didn't do was, A, they didn't call on the division commander, territorial division, in charge of the 65 kilometers of the Gaza border to deploy his troops and be on full alert at dawn, as is customary, by the way, in the Israeli army. And worse than that, they did not call the commander of the Air Force, asking him to do the obvious. Get 10, 12 attack helicopters close by, under ready. And I'm saying 10, 12 attack helicopters would have killed this attack along the fence. But they were not there because he was not alerted. And it took 40 minutes for two attack helicopters to come down, to get down to the front from a base in northern Israel. That's an intelligence failure of unbelievable proportions. And all these people will resign when they have the first opportunity. The second point. So we have, on the one hand, a major failure of Israeli intelligence based on a decade and a half of conviction, what we call in Israel, in good English, conception, that Hamas is deterred. The same way as Hezbollah in Lebanon is deterred since 2006, the war of 2006, the Second Lebanon War. What happened was that over the past 2 years, maybe more, there were very intensive deliberations between leaders of Hamas, the Hezbollah, and the Iranians' Republican Guards Quds Force, which is the organization in charge of all the militias in the region. If you remember Qasem Soleimani, killed by the Americans outside the Baghdad area, he was the father of this organization. In those deliberations, about which the Israelis knew, in those deliberations, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, who is the only guy who counts Yahya Sinwar, 22 years in Israeli prison until he was released in some exchange deal. A guy that I've met quite a few times when he was in prison, fluent in Hebrew, knows everything about Zionist history and Jewish religion. Whatever. Sinwar, who was not present at these deliberations, being in Gaza, had his loyal representatives in the discussions, and he was led to convince, or, to be safe, allowed himself to be convinced that he has a promise from the Iranians and Mr. Nasrallah, Secretary General of Hezbollah, that if he goes on the attack, there will be a second and third front, Lebanon and Syria. I cannot tell you because I don't know whether the Iranians misled him intentionally. I suspect so, but I don't have proof. So he has decided, he didn't share with them, not the 0 hour, not the full scope of the attack he had in mind, for security reasons. There were only three people in the leadership of Hamas: Yahya Sinwar, his brother Muhammad, and another guy, the chief of staff of Hamas, that was probably killed last week. It's not totally clear now, Marwan Issa. They were the only three who knew that the people who were called to the mosques at 3 a.m. in the morning would be sent home, pick your weapons, and report for duty. And they went for the biggest possible operation. They could have decided to attack one or two villages plus one or two military positions, grab hostages, and then negotiate for an exchange with Palestinian prisoners and be victorious. No. Because he had this, what he thought was this Iranian Hezbollah guarantee, he decided to go big. How big? 3,000 on the attack of this Nukba. 60 points entry crossing the Israeli barrier along the border of Gaza, going after every kibbutz and settlement and village and town around Gaza. Sometimes it's 5-10 minutes walk to get there, but they came with Toyotas, the white Toyotas, the new camel, I call it. With the Toyotas, with many motorbikes, gliders, and they went for everything. And the plan was, why does he call it the Al-Aqsa flood? Al-Aqsa is the holy mosque in Jerusalem. Why did he call it the Al-Aqsa flood? He wanted the attackers West Bank, 40 kilometers away, no more, to get to the city of Hebron and light up West Bank like this. Can you imagine what would be the reaction in the West Bank when they see Hamas driving into Hebron and maybe beyond? The orders for the attackers and the kind of equipment they had with them were to stay, to barricade themselves inside Israel and keep fighting from there. This did not happen. Their instructions were to go all the way to the port of Ashdod and certain military and mainly airport, Air Force bases in the south. An extremely ambitious plan. And he knew, I know Sinwar, he knew that this will force Israel to do what Israel never planned to do, and had no plan, by the way, which is to recapture the Gaza Strip. when the war broke out, October 7th, the IDF did not have a plan to take over the Gaza Strip. They had to improvise, call some generals from reserve, etc. Why didn't they reach the West Bank, which would have been a game changer? Because they fell upon this music festival, the Nova, they called it. And there were so many girls there, good looking, and so many hostages to be taken, and people to be butchered. So they stopped. What happened to the Iranian promise? Hezbollah debated about 24 hours what they will do, and they decided they will go for a confrontation restricted to around 5 kilometers across the border, including my home village, Metula, which is the northernmost point in Israel, now totally evacuated like many other towns and villages in the area, and you cannot even visit your orchard because it's a now restricted military zone. And you go there, you will be fired at by Hezbollah. So Hezbollah decided on a limited response, and Syria, long front on the Golan Heights, here comes Mr. Putin. And whatever we think, feel about him, about Syria, he immediately told the Iranians, no go. Syria is out. Russia has invested so much in Syria. Since the outbreak of the civil war in 2011, Russia has two military bases, one naval, one air force, in Tartus and Khmeimim. The Syrian army is not capable of waging a war, and voila, Syria is out. And basically, Syria is out. So the Iranians arranged for the Yemeni Houthis to close shipping to an extent at the Bab el-Mandeb Straits at the southern end of the Red Sea. Now, the war, so this is the background. The war is mostly over. And to give an example, at the height of fighting, we had 5 divisions in Gaza. 7 soldiers and that many tanks and armored carriers and whatever, and of course the Air Force always above. Now we have maybe 3.5 brigades, 7,000. They are outside the cities. What they are doing is, when necessary, when Hamas squads pop up, they will go in, deal with them, and get out. Like is what is happening today again in Shifa Hospital in Gaza, which is the jewel of the reporting of ABC. Well, in the past 24 hours, they have captured another round of a few hundred Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists in Shifa, killed 170 in the last 24 hours. It's all in the bunker system and the tunnel system under the hospital. And the Israeli army goes there with the doctors. They enter with the doctors. They give prior warning. And they come with medicine. It's war, it's ugly, but they come with medicine, with supplies, in order to get down to the tunnel system. And this is the second time the IDF is operating in Shifa, because the first time they played a trick on Hamas. They left, they destroyed much of the bunker system, which sometimes is 40, 60 meters deep in the ground. But they left two big bunkers, two big systems. Now, Hamas felt that they can go back to Shifa Hospital. That's the biggest hospital compound in Gaza. And they came for them. Again, you wouldn't hear about it on ABC. Not that we are, me, because I care about Australia, my wife is Aussie, not that we are not trying to tell them, well, try to see the other information than the one you are broadcasting. The answer is no. Generally, before I go to the what's coming next, we have the constant advertising of the numbers of casualties, civilian casualties, reported by Hamas, disguised as the Health Ministry of Gaza. What Health Ministry of Gaza? I know the guy, Youssef Abu Rish, he's Hamas. And I can refer you with pleasure through Gerard and the number they are giving now, 32 civilian casualties, more than two-thirds women and children, is totally fabricated. According to the latest studies of the casualties reports, the most is 18,000, out of which 12,000 at least are Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters. That's a ratio that was not achieved by the Americans when they were fighting ISIS in Raqqa and Mosul or Fallujah. I'm not here, I'm not the spokesman for the government of Israel or for the IDF, but I don't know any army that had to fight this kind of urban warfare underground amidst very dense civilian population where your adversary is using almost every single house, family homes, etc., as a weapons depot, as a point from which to snipe and shoot and booby trap and whatever you know. The army made millions. How many, but millions. Calls to civilians. Get out of there, we are coming. Leaflets. To the point that the Israeli army provided to the population publicly maps of their deployment and where they are going next. I don't know any other war in which it happened. So now we are in a situation where I said the war is basically over. The main campaign is over. We have Hamas converted from a terrorist army, well-equipped, well-tunneled, converting Hamas from a terrorist army into an armed underground. You still have quite a few Hamas armed squads popping up here and there. And to make it clear, out of 24 battalions of Hamas, their battalions are territorial. Each neighborhood has its battalion with everything. So out of 24, 19 were dismantled. Doesn't mean everybody got killed or injured. And there are four battalions remaining in the city of Rafah, the southern end of the Gaza Strip and the border with Egypt, in which you also have 1.2 million Palestinians, civilians, many of them displaced from the north. The Israeli army is not going to storm Rafah with that many civilians there. And this is why the Security Council resolution, which was not voted, not vetoed by the United States, reflects the situation on the ground. Nobody is going to mount an attack on Rafah during Ramadan, during the holy months of Ramadan, still about 2 weeks to go. What the Israelis will need to do, and I think they will, is to take over the strip, 14 kilometers long, of the border between Gaza and Egypt. Because under this border, the tunnels there allowed Hamas for years to get equipped, to get weapons, to get components for assembling weapons in workshops in Gaza, usually, by the way, underground. And if you don't seal the border with Egypt, what did you achieve? We have very good cooperation with Egypt, but we cannot change Egypt. I'm speaking to you as somebody who lived years in Egypt and who loves Egypt, because there are ways to get Egyptian officers and police guards and whatever you know to cooperate with the smuggling. Fact of life. And then you seal Rafah from the along the border with Egypt and from the north. And if they take my advice, that why should they? I would offer terms for surrender to this. This is the worst brigade of Hamas, by the way. I would offer terms for surrender. If you won't go out to Iran, Algeria, Syria, I don't care. I don't believe this brigade is going to fight. I don't believe we are going to see a Palestinian Masada in Rafah. But I may be. Where we are going from here? Number one question is to get the humanitarian aid flowing in. Dropping from the air, even if King Abdullah of Jordan is in the cockpit, getting a nice photo. Or the Americans building now a floating pier off the coast of Gaza City. It's not a response, because Gaza needs 600 truckloads a day of supplies. And 10% can come through Egypt, because the crossing point is not equipped to deal with large traffic, but it can come from different crossings from Israel, and it does. I can report to you, and I'm happy about it, prices in the markets in Gaza, in the food markets of Gaza, have dropped over the last few days over 50%. Because whatever the convoys brings becomes part of a black market, mainly by Hamas. Hamas, normally, at least in Rafah region now, working behind UNRWA, which has been gutted by Hamas years ago. So get the humanitarian aid going. There is no, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm in touch with them, including Mr. Sinwar, there is no famine in Gaza. And I don't think we are going there. Number two, there needs to be an understanding on what's going to be the governance of Gaza, bearing in mind that whoever takes responsibility in Gaza, and it's not going to be Israel, will have to cope with the Hamas as an armed underground. They're not going away. So the Israelis, I assume, will keep the current level of military presence inside Gaza, outside the cities, so as to demonstrate to everybody we are here if it's needed, and when needed, go in and go out. Do the job and go out, like in Shifa now. It's one battalion of the 401 Brigade, which I was a proud member of in the 73 war, which goes in, deals with Shifa, and then will go out. So whatever government you will have in Gaza will, at least in the beginning, have the guarantee that the IDF is there. And the drones are in the sky, and Air Force, if needed, in the sky. There are no bombings in Gaza anymore. Who can take over Gaza? Nobody will come to police Gaza. Not the Arabs, not the Europeans, Americans, nobody. It has to be some arrangement through which Palestinians can take it. Now, the people with the big money, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are not willing to deal with the Palestinian Authority. They detest President Abbas. They refuse to deal with him. They urge him, just like the Americans do, to reform, or as it's called, revitalize the Palestinian Authority. That means cleanse it from corruption and fix the patronage system, etc. Or they are not coming. And they have an interest in coming because they want the port in Gaza. Rebuild. Because the port in Gaza fits the general American-sponsored plan for the alternative trade corridor to the BRI, the IMEC, India-Middle East corridor, ending, going through Saudi Arabia with railways, highways, pipelines, cables to Israel. And the Saudis and the UAE naturally would like to have also Gaza as part of this, the two Israeli ports. It can be a big boost to rebuilding of Gaza, to as it was. You're not going to build back the refugee camps. You're going to build, once you get to it, you want to build a different Gaza. So here is the formula that I think will be, is the most reasonable. An agency run by Palestinians, not the apparatchiks of the PA, linked to the PA, but not subordinate to the PA, supervised by the World Bank, audited by, you choose, PwC, Deloitte, whoever, in charge of the reconstruction and rebuilding of Gaza. I know Israel will cooperate. If I have 1 minute, I'll say something about Israel. In Israel, it's very messy. We have a prime minister who constant quarrel with the chief of the military and establishment and defense forces. We have a war cabinet with a lot of infighting between Bibi and his new partners who joined for the war. We have a build-up of resentment against him and his coalition government that started before the war with his judicial reform, which he still clings to, and has now been reinforced. So you have two reservoirs of political energy which are going to come to play whenever people in Israel feel that the war is basically over and hopefully hostages or at least some are back, that will come into play. One is the hundreds of thousands who protested against the judicial reform. They are still there. Some of them are demonstrating now, but people don't feel comfortable to demonstrate when you have every second day a soldier killed in Gaza. The second reservoir is the civil society organizations, volunteers, hundreds of thousands, who replaced a dysfunctional government taking care of the population, especially those evacuated in the north and south, when the government ministries were absolutely not present. Like organizations like Brothers in Arms, etc. They did a wonderful job. And the third is almost 300,000 reservists who were mostly released by now. I have quite a few of them in my family. I'm not taking them anymore. I'm not being called anymore to reserve. And they are angry. They are angry. And if you remember in 73, after the 73 war, October war of 73, it took few dozens of thousands of demonstrators to get the great Golda Meir to resign. I thought it was unjustified then. I certainly think so, especially after I've seen Alan Mirren act. But we had a prime minister who was encouraged to resign by street peaceful demonstrations. And now it will be bigger. To conclude, I think Bibi understands. He sees the polls, but his departure, I'm afraid, is going to be an ugly departure. Thank you.
Well, many thanks, Ehud Yairi, for a very comprehensive and enlightening analysis. We've got about 15 minutes, so everyone's got to be very short with their comments or questions, and we'll get through as many as we can. So you can hop back up here and talk to the back of the room again. Just hang on. Sinwar, I think he went to prison in Israel for murdering Palestinians. Is that right? Okay. And he served 22 years.
Yes.
Can the war end without Sinwar's capture?
It's difficult because Sinwar is surrounding himself with hostages. Now, nominally, we have 133 hostages now, supposedly in the hands of Hamas. If there are 70, I would be happy. But Sinwar makes sure he's surrounding these hostages to deter the Israelis from taking action, from bombing wherever he is, even if they know. And I think they have a fairly good idea where he is. One more point. We have to understand Sinwar by now is alienated from the rest of the Hamas leadership, including inside Gaza. And they are telling him, what did you do? Where do you think you were going? So can we reach an end point with Sinwar still alive somewhere? I think so, probably.
I will be quick, thank you. What do you think China and Russia are thinking, particularly after the Moscow attack of the weekend?
The Moscow attack is a different opera. It's ISIS, Khorasan, Afghanistan, has to do with a long settling a long account that they have with the Russians over many other issues. The Chinese have decided to take a staunchly, for the first time, a staunchly anti-Israeli stance. The Russians, the same. But when it comes to the practicalities, the Chinese are not in the Middle East. India is much more present militarily, navy-wise, in the Middle East. The Russians are there, and I'll give you just an example. To this moment, a Russian Air Force officer sits in the Russian base in Khmeimim near Latakia, Turkey, on a hotline with an Israeli Russian-speaking officer at our Air Force command, and the Israeli will tell him 10 minutes before there is some raid on Iranian convoys in Syria, we are taking to air. And what will the Russians do? Turn off the radars and make sure all their planes have landed. So the Russians have a lot to say, but in practical terms, they do not hinder the operation.
Would you enlarge on what the current dispute is that you mentioned between the Israeli military and the Israeli political scene?
It's not the political scene, it's Bibi.
What is the dispute?
The dispute is Bibi is trying to shift the blame for the failure of October 7th exclusively to the army. His entourage, including a son who is safely in Florida, keep hinting that the performance of the army was lacking. In cabinet meetings, never before in Israel, Bibi allows ministers that he has appointed, some of them real hooligans. He allows them to insult the chief of staff, to attack him, to criticize him and then leak it to the media, which is always happy, to get a good leak. They are hardly on speaking terms. You know, people sitting in the war cabinet, some of them happen to be good friends of mine for years, they're saying you have two Bibis now. One Bibi is the Bibi of the past, serious, considerate, thoughtful. The other Bibi is the guy who calculates all the time his political, personal considerations. And when they go into a meeting, they don't know which Bibi they will meet this time.
Two quick questions. One quick question. The Americans said yesterday that they have a unique plan to solve the Rafah issue without Israel going in there. Is there any intelligence on what that would be? Is it just a piper where they will all follow out?
I think it indicates in the direction that I have suggested, that you can deal with Rafah without storming Rafah. This is under discussion. You constantly have American top-level military presence in Israel, talking on a daily, hourly basis with the Israelis who are running the war. I think there is a fair amount of understanding by the Americans that you have to finish the job. You cannot tolerate Hamas anymore. You're not going to make experiments. That means Rafah has to be dealt with. But it's not necessarily through, you know, sending a division into this crowded area. I think it's pretty much in agreement And this is why I don't see this, the Security Council resolution and the fact that the Americans abstained from a veto as a big catastrophe, because the Americans knew we are not going, certainly not in Ramadan, into Rafah. So, okay, we have a resolution.
Egypt and Jordan have long-standing peace treaties with Israel. From 1979-1994, they both survived. They've both got contiguous borders. They are both large population countries with Sunni Muslim population. Can you explain to us why Egypt and Jordan don't try and take responsibility for their neighboring Palestinian populations?
Jordan is a very weak country, unfortunately, very fragile, now being threatened by the massing of Iranian Shiite militias along its borders with Iraq and Syria. And I was speaking about the drug trafficking and the weapons smuggling. It's serious. So Jordan is tied elsewhere, and since the population of Jordan is 65% Palestinian, roughly so, the king is very reluctant to deal with his own street. Egypt, on the verge of bankruptcy, saved now by UAE, paying $25 billion for a piece of the coastline along the Mediterranean, west of Alexandria, $25 billion. The last thing Egypt wants to see is what they saw a few years ago, thousands of Palestinians moving into Egypt. So they have bulldozed on their side all 3 kilometers wide strip along the border with Gaza. And they are saying, deploy tanks. And they are saying, if Palestinians are trying to break through, they will be shot at. That's the Egyptian position.
If I say to you, ultimately, the blood of every single Palestinian civilian, either dead or injured, is ultimately on the hands of the Iranian Ayatollahs, and actually, in the big picture, nothing is going to change in the long term without dealing with the Iranian Ayatollahs. Comments, please.
I agree with you, but everything has, there is a time for everything. I don't think now is the time, because I don't think the Iranians, in spite of all their enrichment, 60% and sometimes by mistake beyond to 82%, I don't think the Iranians are in a hurry to assemble a bomb, although they can. And we know they know how to do it. So sometime we need to, all of us in the Middle East and the Western allies, all of us, we need to deal a blow, severe blow, to their proxies first. That's a must, because this is the vanguard. The Iranians are willing to fight to the last Arab, whether he's a Shiite, a Sunni, or a Zaidi, like in Yemen. Not yet. And I don't think that it's in Israel's best interest to take on Iran on its own. Because whatever damage we can cause them will be this or that way short-lived. So yes, Iran is the head of the snake, as we say in Hebrew, but everything has its own time.
Okay. My question is regarding PR from Israel in the world. many of your points, like the amount of innocent deaths versus military deaths, does not come across in the world. And so Israel gets to be like the pariah. Yeah. Why is that so? Why isn't Israel doing better in that department? Because from Hamas's point of view, they're winning that war.
Because we have a totally dysfunctional government, a foreign ministry that has been allowed to sink to the bottom. We had, for example, a good spokesman in English who got sacked yesterday, I think, who got sacked because the wife of Mr. Netanyahu doesn't like the fact that at one point he participated in the demonstrations. So they take a guy who was doing very well in English, especially in UK, and they sack him. We have a government which is not functioning anymore. Most of the ministries do not. The foreign ministry was allowed to be degraded. So you can look around. They don't concentrate on this. My wife, the Aussie, she says, the problem is Israelis are more interested in having debates amongst themselves than talking to the outside. And it's true.
Can I be very quick? Yes.
Yeah. All right. Just one sort of question. UNRWA, where does it go from here? When does it go? Whatever.
UNRWA has been taken over by Hamas long ago. In 2009, they captured the Union of UNRWA Workers. What is UNRWA? It's 30,000 Palestinians working in UNRWA, many of them affiliated this way, that way with Hamas, certainly obeying Hamas orders, and few dozens of Westerners, mainly, who don't speak Arabic, who live in sort of secluded, they call it pensions in Gaza, no more, but they used to. So there is no control. The head of UNRWA, Mr. Lazzarini, so often on television, I'm sure he's a favorite of ABC, Mr. Lazzarini is not in the region at all. If you want to reach him, please, Geneva. They are detached. And what the IDF found was that many of the facilities of UNRWA served as Hamas bases. Because they thought, Hamas, that if they are inside or under a UNRWA facility, the Israelis will be hesitant. And they were for years, but not now.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, I just want to say to Ehud Yare, thanks for a wonderful performance tonight. And we've learned a lot, and I've learned a lot, I'm sure you all have. Everyone's busy, and you've got another appointment, so congratulations and good luck.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay.